Roach arranged for the paint to be tested by Dr. Zamatolsky, a chemist. Zamatolsky was an educated man and thought it extremely unlikely any phosphorus would be in the paint, as this had never been hinted at as an ingredient. Without having run a single test, he wrote sagely to Roach on 30th of January 1923, "It is my belief that the serious condition of the jaw has been caused by the influence of radium." This was a radical idea, yet Zamatolsky's off-the-wall suggestion did have some science to back it up. In a bibliography of radium studies that USRC itself had published just 4 months before, there was an article headed "Radium Dangers, Injurious Effects." In fact, the bibliography contained articles as far back as 1906 on the damage radium could cause. The company conceded in an internal memo that there were a considerable number of articles dealing with the hazards from the early 20th century. A woman had even died in Germany in 1912 after being treated with radium. Her doctor had said, "One cannot doubt but for a moment that radium poisoning was the cause." Yet the flip side of the coin was all the positive literature about radium. As early as 1914, specialists knew that radium could deposit in the bones of radium users and that it caused changes in their blood. These blood changes, however, were interpreted as a good thing. The radium appeared to stimulate the bone marrow to produce extra red blood cells. Deposited inside the body, radium was the gift that kept on giving. But if you looked a little closer at all those positive publications, there was a common denominator. The researchers, on the whole, worked for radium firms. As radium was such a rare and mysterious element, its commercial exploiters in fact controlled, to an almost monopolising extent, its image and most of the knowledge about it. Many firms had their own radium-themed journals, which were distributed free to doctors, all full of optimistic research. The firms that profited from radium medicine were the primary producers and publishers of the positive literature. Zamatolsky's opinion, therefore, was a lone, unheard, and hypothetical voice, set against the flamboyant roar of a well-funded campaign of pro-radium literature. Zamatolsky himself, however, was a conscientious as well as smart man. Given his tests would take a few months, and mindful of the fact that work was continuing in the dial painting studio, he took care to add a special note to his letter of 30th of January. Though his radical theory had not yet been proven, he wrote plainly, "I would suggest that every operator be warned through a printed leaflet of the dangers of getting this material on the skin or into the system, especially the mouth, and that they be forced to use the utmost cleanliness." Yet, for some reason, this did not happen. Perhaps the message was never passed on. Perhaps the company chose to ignore it. As 1923 drew on and Zamatolsky ran his tests, Irene Rudolph, who had been sent home from hospital, continued to endure the horrific ulcers and sores that had tortured Molly Maggia. Irene's anemia grew more serious, as did Helen Quinlan's. They were pale, weak creatures, with no energy to them, no life. Doctors treated them first for one thing and then another, but not a single treatment helped. And they weren't the only ones who were sick. Since George Willis, the co-founder of the Orange Radium firm, had been ousted from his company, things had deteriorated for him. It seemed a long time ago that he had thoughtlessly carried tubes of radium with his bare hands every day at work. But all time is relative. With a half-life of 1,600 years, radium could take its time to make itself known. As the months had passed since his departure from the company, Willis had sickened, and in September 1922, the same month Molly Maggia died, he'd had his right thumb amputated. Tests revealed that it was riddled with cancer.